good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and it's that time of year again. We're sliding into the holiday season. It seems like it was just here, and we're back. And the year end is approaching, maybe not rapidly enough for some. But we're here a bit early this year. We want to present you year-end tax tips for your income tax returns, for things that are coming up for the end of this year. My immediate guess is not much has changed over last year, but my guests will have a bit to say about that. And speaking of guests, I have some of the best. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can ask us any of your tax questions. You don't have to jump in where we are in our conversation. Our guests can't provide you legal advice with all the facts, but they can sure give you a good idea how to make decisions and what the law might be. I've alluded to my guests. Just who do I got here with tonight? Well, to guide us through this overview, we have Frank Adam of Pacifica, who's always been a great supporter of both Your Legal Rights and our Call a Lawyer Night feature. Frank's an attorney and a real estate broker and a certified public accountant. And Cindy Ho of Cindy Ho Law APC in San Jose. Cindy has... well, this says over 20 years. I think you're even more. Over 20 years of experience focused extensively on tax controversy and litigation. She possesses significant experience in advising and advocating for the individual, for small businesses, for corporate clients on numerous tax issues before federal and state taxing agencies. I could go on, but these are the folks. And Cindy, Frank, without further ado, let me welcome both of you to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening, Jeff.
Hi. Hi, Jeff. Good to be back.
You know, I guess to frame our discussion and just get people started, let me ask you both, what should I be doing between now and the end of the year?
Go ahead, Frank. Take this one since you prepare tax returns.
Okay. Get your records together. Make sure that the information you're going to give to your tax preparer is complete and accurate. Keep a file. You're going to be getting 1099, W-2s, all of that stuff. Keep a file of that either via paper or these days sometimes, many times it comes electronically. Make sure you're able to transmit all of that information to your tax preparer in a complete form. The less exchange back and forth you have, the more easily the tax preparer can prepare the return and accurately can prepare the return. So getting records together is the big thing. If you have a business, make sure that your books are up to date, your ledgers, journals, what have you. If you use an automobile, make sure your mileage log is complete. If you don't have one, better start putting one together. I would say predominantly that's the main thing to worry about between now and the end of the year. You might want, for people that are self-employed, you might want to start looking at some tax planning. If you have a lot of income and you need replace equipment, the end of the year is a good time to do that. You'll be able to take advantage of accelerated or bonus depreciation, and that can bring down your gross and adjusted gross income, which will benefit you both on the federal and the state side. So you can do it. You've got about a month and a couple of days to do some tax planning with regard to equipment purchases. Retirement plan contributions can be made up through, depending on the plan, through the extended due dates of the return. So another thing you might want to do if you don't have cash is start creating, go through your cash budget or create a cash budget and make sure you'll have enough money to contribute to whatever retirement plans you've established.
Cindy, do you want to jump in and add anything to that?
Well, under the Big Beautiful Bill, they restored the bonus depreciation that Frank had mentioned. So it's 100% bonus depreciation. There are some limitations. So if you're a small business owner or a business owner, you want to capitalize on that. In addition, you want to make sure that your books and records are up to date. If you are self-employed or have a business and you're required to make estimated tax payments, the last estimated tax payment is due January 15th of 2026. So having your financials in order and a projection of what your net income is would be helpful in calculating your estimated tax payments to avoid late estimated tax payment penalties.
And that's both to a regular taxpayer, but also an employer who may have employees to deal with. You have to give them the right information so they can move on.
That's right.
What's the deadline for that?
For employers to issue W-2s, it's the end of January. So January 31st, that's when the employer is supposed to issue W-2s to their employees.
For independent contractors, is the same date applies to 1099s?
Yes, the same date applies for 1099s as well. And there's also a change this year January 1st of 2026. The threshold that requires the taxpayer to issue a 1099 was $600, and now that's bumping up to $2,000.
So the people that might have come in and put in a day or two, you don't have the 1099 anymore once that takes effect.
Yes, if it's less than $2,000. But you want to make sure you have a receipt for what you pay that person, because if it's like on a rental property and you're getting work done on the property, you need to establish how much you paid that person or proof of payment of that expenditure. Same with the business as well.
So it may benefit that person you're not putting them through, but you want to make sure that you have the records that you don't pay tax on it, or at least you have the ability to deduct when appropriate.
That's right.
And also, if you would ordinarily receive a 1099 under the current law and you don't get one under the new law, that does not exempt you from reporting the income. The lack of a 1099 does not mean you don't have to report the income, because if you don't and they find out, you're going to pay substantial penalties and interest.
Let me turn to our first caller, Boris. You're on the air. Welcome to your legal rights.
Hey, first time, long time. I'm all up to date. My brother has not paid taxes in many years and is kind of flying under the radar. And I want to know what happens when he tries to collect Social Security or get on Medicare or any of those things, and they see he hasn't paid any taxes. He hasn't filed for taxes, I should say, in like, 10, 15, 20 years. He hasn't filed for taxes.
So when you don't file taxes,
throw the book at him?
Well, there will be consequences. So if you don't file tax returns, the state and the IRS, if there's income reported or there's information that he's like, let's say he's a licensed contractor or a licensed real estate agent, they can just make an assessment of what the liability according to them, and oftentimes they're wrong. So the IRS and the state will create a liability, and then that will give them the ability to collect. So the best thing is, if you have an assessment, to file a return to replace that assessment, obviously as long as it brings it down. In terms of Social Security, the IRS has the ability to issue a levy on 15% of Social Security. So they'll take that off the top. They could also send bank levies, to your banks and seize everything in the account, obviously not more than what you owe. And the state has this similar type of power as well. It's always my philosophy, because I do have a lot of clients that come to me. They don't have filed returns. They've ignored it for a really long time. He may qualify for a settlement. He gets current on all the tax returns. If he doesn't have the ability to pay all of that back, and it sounds like he's close to retirement, because he's going to be eligible for Social Security, he might want to consider an offer in compromise with the IRS and the FTB.
You mentioned a couple things. One is offer and compromise. Does that really happen for most folks, or is that only for people that don't currently have an income?
No. Well, the FTB requires that you have to be working in order to be eligible to submit an offer. So you actually have to be working unless you're like disabled, unable to work. You can establish that with records, medical records. For the IRS, they don't have a requirement that you have to be employed. However, one of the reasons for a denial for an offer in compromise or a settlement could be they don't think it's in the best interest of the government. So, for example, if you have a person that's unemployed and it's clear that they have expenses, unless they're independently wealthy, and if they are, they shouldn't be submitting an offer in compromise. But unless they're able to afford their living expenses indefinitely, the government will say, look, this is a temporary situation. At some point you will get a job. And come to us when you do have a job and we can do our analysis to see if a settlement is appropriate at that time. So they could put the taxpayer on a hardship where they don't have to pay anything, but interest and penalties continue to accrue. And they'll say, no settlement right now, come back to us when you have a job. Pretty much all of my clients who I've negotiated offers for successfully, they were all employed or had a business generating some level of income.
What about the person who filed all the returns but didn't pay all the taxes?
So if there's options of like installment agreements, so you can get on a payment plan. So if you don't qualify for an offer, there's always an installment agreement. If you have a reasonable basis for not filing on time or not paying on time, you can seek a penalty abatement. However, for the late payment penalty, you actually have to pay the tax first in order to be eligible for the related penalty to be abated. The IRS and the FTB also have a first-time abatement program. So let's say this is the first time you've ever been late, first time you've ever paid late. The FTB and the IRS, they have a first-time abatement program. However, the FTB doesn't offer that first-time abatement to businesses, just individuals.
So we spoke a little bit about government benefits. We talked about Medicare, and Medicare, as I understand it, requires that you have a certain number of years of work before they'll start paying you Medicare. Isn't that also a problem for... I believe Boris said his brother. Wouldn't that be a problem if the person wasn't working and paying taxes in enough quarters to qualify?
Yes. Yeah. So I have some clients who, for whatever reason, they don't have established income that was reported to Social Security. So they don't have enough in terms of paid into Social Security and therefore aren't eligible for that as well. So, for example, if your brother did work, and let's say he was paid as an employee, the employer takes out the Social Security and Medicare, the employer pays their share directly. So that's paid. So that will count towards Social Security. What's not being paid if you don't pay your taxes are the income taxes related to that. And just because you don't pay income taxes, as long as you have paid into Social Security, you will be eligible for benefits. I don't know what the metrics are on that, though, like how much you have to work and how much you have to pay in.
It gets more challenging when the person is self-employed.
Yes, it does.
You know, we talked a little bit about government benefits. When are those benefits taxable? What types of benefits are taxable? What types might not be?
Frank, do you want to take this one?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So Social Security is taxable. However, depending upon your income, if your income, like for example, let's say you have Social Security, and also in addition to that, you're still working and you have wages, and then you have passive income. If your income exceeds a certain amount, some of your Social Security income or all of your Social Security income may be subject to tax. So, So Social Security income is taxable, but only if your adjusted gross income is over a certain amount. There's also unemployment income is taxable at the federal level. There was 1 year during the pandemic where the IRS had, I think it was $19,000 that was exempt. Their disability income, so if you're getting disability benefits, that's typically not taxable from the government. Let's see, is there any other form of government benefits? Unemployment, well, I think we covered that. Unemployment income.
Well, some of the other stuff you don't normally think of paying tax on, food stamps, you know, general relief, people should probably not be receiving that if they're in an income level that they should be paying taxes. I would think that would not be taxable.
Yes. Food stamps would not be taxable.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. Tonight we're offering up tax tips for year's end, but we're really here to answer any of your tax questions. Joining me tonight is Cindy Ho of Cindy Ho Law in San Jose. Ms. Ho is a member of the taxation section of the California Lawyers Association. Also joining us is Frank Adam of Pacifico, who's been a great supporter of Your Legal Rights and our Call a Lawyer Night feature. Frank is a certified public accountant, attorney, and real estate broker. If you have questions for my guests, and again, we're offering free tax advice. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call regarding any question. You want to talk about tax law. You want to talk about your own taxes. You want to talk about where you are as a business. You want to talk about any of this, your fights with the IRS. You don't have to join in the very moment we may be in our conversation. 866-798-8255. In hearing you talk about Social Security, wasn't that part of the president's plan? Wasn't that supposed to be no longer taxable under the big, beautiful bill?
Yes, but that did not pass. So in lieu of that, what's happened is they have allowed seniors who are 65 and above to claim an additional exemption. So if you're married filing joint, and only one spouse is 65 or older, there's a $6,000 exemption. If both spouses are 65 or over, then the exemption is $12,000. So that's subtracted from the taxable income or the income at which you arrive, from which you arrive at taxable income. So that helps. It depends on how much you're receiving in Social Security. If you're receiving some $30,000, you'll say, and you're both over 65, $12,000 of that will not be taxed, assuming the rest of it is taxable. So it was something, but not everything.
And that's only if you're collecting Social Security.
Correct. If you're single and you're 65 or older, it's $6,000. Or head of household, it's also $6,000. So you're getting some benefit, but exempting all of Social Security, I don't think was palatable to the Congress.
Beth from Berkeley, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, my question is about the changes coming up in 2026 regarding charitable deductions. Can you explain them?
So one of the changes with charitable deductions are beginning in 2026, only contributions exceeding 0.5% of your AGI are deductible. So you can consider doing charitable deductions in you know, multiple years, if that's in 1 year. So for example, if you have a large charitable deduction, you may just want to do it in 1 year as opposed to splitting it between 2 years because of that limitation. One other change is that if you don't do itemized deductions, you can deduct, I believe it's up to $1,000 for a single person or $2,000 for married filing joint for cash donations. Were there any other changes, Frank? Sorry?
No, that's what I'm seeing as well. It's $1,000 for single, $2,000 for married filing joint. And 5.5% was the adjusted gross income limit. So,
I don't understand what you mean by that. Do you mean that the first 5.5% of one's adjusted gross income? I'm sorry, I really don't understand what you're saying. And I'm talking about, of course, for people who itemize.
Okay, you take your itemized you take your charitable contributions.
Yes.
And you compare that to 0.5% of what's called your adjusted gross income.
Okay.
Charitable contributions that exceed 0.5% of the adjusted gross income, you may deduct as itemized deductions. However, those deductions are added to the other itemized deductions that you have. And if it's above the standard deduction, then you benefit from that charitable contribution. If it's below the standard deduction, it's of no benefit at all because the standard deduction is higher. And the standard deductions have gone up considerably.
Okay.
They've gone from 31,000 to 32,500, I believe, for married filing joint. It's very similar to the medical expenses that have to exceed 7.5% of adjusted gross income. This is a very low threshold. It's 0.5%.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Beth, thank you for joining us in your legal rights. We talked a little bit about some of the provisions of the Big Beautiful Bill. What else has changed since last year?
One change that became permanent was the qualified business income deduction. So that's the 20% exclusion for business owners, and that was permanent. It was supposed to sunset in January 1st of 2026.
What does that actually do, a qualified business deduction?
So for example, I'm a business owner, and let's say hypothetically my net income is 300,000. Now there are some rules that affect this QBI, that's what we call it, QBI deduction. But if my net income is 300,000, 20% of that is 60,000. So what I would have to pay taxes on would not be the 300,000, but it would be 300,000 minus 60,000. So it reduces taxable income for business owners.
And what's required to be considered a business owner? You're a professional. Would you be covered per se?
So you could be self-employed. You can have a Schedule C. You can have a S corporation. You can have an LLC. You can have a partnership. Those would qualify. C corporations do not qualify because the C corporations already had a lower tax rate under the first Trump tax bill. So the QBI deduction was a provision which allowed people with, you know, these type of other entities to have a benefit of a lower tax rate to be equivalent to the C corporation tax rates.
So it extends the old adage, corporations don't pay taxes, people do. And in the end, any business ultimately doesn't pay taxes. Their customer base does, or their client base does.
I don't know that I would agree with that. Everybody pays some form of tax. If you have a business, you're going to pay income tax. If you're self-employed, you're going to pay Social Security tax in the form of self-employment tax. So all entities pay tax in one form or another. I've been self-employed since I was a junior in college. I've never gotten away with not paying tax, and I can't pass my tax bill on to my clients. It doesn't, that, I kind of, I disagree with that concept that all taxes are passed through to the customer. There's much more to that than that simple articulation.
Do you agree with that, Cindy?
I do. However, I think that they're very big corporations that have sophisticated, I guess, tax planning, where they minimize their tax exposure in the U.S. if they can pull that income offshore. So I think what you're referring to, Jeff, is that, you know, Apple doesn't pay any tax in the U.S. You know, I think they do pay tax, but they probably pay a lot less tax, you know, given very sophisticated tax planning.
Actually, to elicit the responses that I just got, I quoted Ronald Reagan, who said that. And ultimately, his point was that when you tax our larger corporations, they're going to pass those costs on in the form of higher prices. And ultimately, at some way or another, you're going to be paying those taxes. And they never really extended it to cover the rest of us in the same way. We can't pass that along. And I agree with your assessment, but that was really a way to flesh that out. We want to be one of the things I wanted to ask you about tonight, and I think we'll wait until the second half, which is almost upon us, is we're a couple of years past the pandemic, and we're about a year past the point where the government has been very, very actively cutting out those stimulus measures that were present, may have lasted a bit long and led to quite a bit of inflation. Have any changes been made over the past year to deal with those stimulus measures? Do any of that bleed into our tax laws right now?
Well, under the Big Beautiful Bill, one of the benefits during the pandemic was the ERC refund for businesses. So if businesses kept their employees, the government had a program where you could file for ERC credits. So essentially, you'd be getting money back from the government. And in the Big Beautiful Bill, they extended the statute of limitations to audit ERC credit claims for Q3 and Q4 for tax year 2021. And they extended that the extension to, I believe it's 2028. So they're giving more time to the IRS to potentially audit these claims. And my sense is because the government at one period of time, the IRS had the backlog of cases and issued a moratorium over processing ERC claims. That moratorium was lifted, but there's still a lot of ERC payments that haven't been paid, still being processed. And now the IRS has a lot more time to audit these claims later on. And they're looking for whether or not taxpayers qualify for the credits. And they're looking for fraud. They're looking for those type of things as well.
Then again, if the news is to be believed, there are fewer people working for the IRS these days. But I would imagine that they might have automated some of that ability to search us without necessarily having as many folks. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Started off on the wrong foot. Literally, the only pair of sneakers I took with me to Puerto Rico were stolen out of my suitcase at the airport. So I had to wear flip-flops in the mountains until my mom, who was in New York, forced my dad to get me some sneakers.
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, it's all about the shoes. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth Radio Hour tonight at 7 o'clock on 91.7 FM KALW San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. We now return to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden.
And before we jump right back into it, I would like to encourage you to call in. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. And as I've mentioned, we're offering up tax tips for the year end. We're giving free tax advice. What do you want to do between now and the end of the year? That's the bottom line. We're going to be talking about investments. We're going to be talking about virtual currency, prepaying taxes, medical, charitable deductions, those three martini lunches. You want to hear about those? Or I'd rather ask specific questions of your own. Give us a call. I have some great guests tonight. I have Cindy Ho of Cindy Ho Law, APC in San Jose. I have Frank Adam of Pacifica, who's an attorney, accountant, real estate broker. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call us with any of your tax questions. You want to talk about taxation? You want to talk about the IRS? We're here. You don't have to limit it to where we are in our conversation. I saw somebody start to get through. Call didn't quite get through. Try again. In the meantime, let me ask you. We're a year into new changes in the power structure in Washington. We've seen huge swaths of the government go away. What other possible changes might be in store if you have your crystal ball in the next years to come?
Well, the changes have already started happening. I've definitely felt them in my practice. From what I've been told, about half of like the audit department's collectors have been cut in half. And these are from employees that were probationary employees and were let go. And then these are also senior IRS employees who took the early retirement offer. And how it's affected my practice, my clients' cases, is I've seen like an audit case where I've had multiple auditors. So it's not uncommon, and my colleagues have shared similar experiences where you'll have an auditor disappear, another auditor, and then you have a third auditor or fourth auditor. In some cases, that's helped my clients because there's so much backlog in cases and less people to work them that some of these audits are closing with no adjustments. So it's definitely a win for some taxpayers. However, for the taxpayers who have issues with the IRS and need the IRS to do something in their case to correct an error, those clients are definitely feeling the changes in the government because I've seen a lot of time pass by where nothing's happening. And the shutdown did not help us as well. So that's creating additional backlog.
When we were talking before the show, we talked a little bit about the salt cap. Before I ask you the follow-up questions, who would like to tell us about what a salt cap refers to or the salt limit?
So under the previous Trump tax bill, the bill put a limit on deductions for state and local tax. So for example, if you pay state income tax, and everyone will if you're earning taxable income, and you pay local tax like sales tax, property tax would be considered a local tax. If you add up all those taxes are an itemized deduction. Now, one exception is that you can't deduct sales tax and income tax, but you have an itemized deduction for state and local tax payments. And there wasn't a cap on what that amount was until the first Trump tax bill that was passed in 2017. Now, under the Big Beautiful Bill, the old bill limit it to $10,000. So before, there wasn't a limitation. So if you owned a house in California, bought it within the last 5 years, you probably have a huge tax bill. And under the old rule, you are limited to $10,000. That's all you can deduct. Doesn't matter how much income tax you pay, doesn't matter how much property tax you pay. So it definitely affected people in California, people in New York, people that live in states where property taxes are much higher. However, now under the Big Beautiful Bill, that $10,000 limit got increased to $40,000. So I'm really happy about that. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be happy about that, although it's not as good as the old rule, which was there wasn't any limitation.
Frank, you're muted. I see Frank trying to speak to us. He'll be with us momentarily. Yes, welcome back.
I want to add something to that. The complaint about the salt tax, in many cases, disregarded the idea and the fact that state and local taxes are what's called tax preference items. And tax preference items are added back to income for the purposes of assessing the alternative minimum tax. And in many cases, the deduction of the state and local tax was offset dollar for dollar by the alternative minimum tax. And that might happen here again as well, although the thresholds for the alternative minimum tax are higher now. So it wasn't quite the windfall that it was represented to be. So there are some benefits to having it. There are some downsides to having it, depending on where you fall on the income scale.
Tell our listeners what the alternative minimum tax means.
It's a tax levied against what was supposed to be the wealthiest of Americans, but it hits a lot of people, or did hit a lot of people, that you might not be considered wealthy. So that's the simple version of it. It was enacted many, many years ago because a relatively small number of people paid no tax after these deductions. So they established something called the alternative minimum tax, which takes into account certain items of income or certain deductions that are added back to your normal taxable income to arrive at something called the alternative minimum taxable income. And it's not exactly a straightforward calculation.
So that's a catch-all if they see too big a disparity between how much tax you're paying and what they project you should be paying on your income? Is that basically what's been happening?
I wouldn't go that far. It's simply a means of collecting more tax from people of a particular income level. That's it.
But of course, with inflation, many of us are now earning the money that, when that was established, sounded like you were rich.
Well, these days, before the first tax bill under President Trump, it was the alternative minimum tax was affecting lots of people I would not consider rich or wealthy. It was hitting many people who I would think are high middle income tax earners and taxpayers. So it's a complicated issue. But the salt limitation, getting back to the salt limitations, you may be able to deduct some of that. You may be able to deduct the state and local taxes, but you might get stuck paying some alternative minimum tax depending on your total taxable income. You need to look at the schedule when your tax preparer prepares it.
So it sounds as though if you're not taking a lot of other deductions, it's probably a good thing that they have this limit extended. But if you've taken a lot of deductions and you're stacking this on top, this alternative minimum tax may come and bite you anyway.
Yes, that's correct. It might.
So my follow-up question when I asked about the salt limit was what we should do about it. Should we all go out and buy bigger houses or maybe cash in on what we got?
I don't know about that. I don't think you should let the tax tail wag the business dog. Buying a big house has its own issues. There's interest. There's the property tax on that. There's the cost of maintaining such a home. People should make their, in my opinion, financial decisions based on their capacity to afford whatever it is they want or whatever it is they feel they need.
I have a friend who's very concerned about taxes. He hates the idea of paying taxes. It really offends him when he pays more taxes. But his income's gone up dramatically. I try to explain to him it's not how much tax you pay, it's how much you get to keep. But that's a hard one to sell. Let me take a call from Justine in Berkeley. Justine, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hi. So I retired in late 2020, and I get Social Security, and then I took a lump sum but had a finance guy invest that, and so I get a monthly payment from that. I have not filed my taxes for the last 3 years. Now, I always get a refund, but I'm wondering if I can do all 3 years on like one of the tax things that, you know, they help you for free. Because when I checked out like with HR or something, H&R Block, it was going to be like $300 or $400 for each year. And I'm concerned also, is there a penalty, even though I don't usually pay, and I'm assuming nothing's changed in my income, if I will have penalties.
If you have a refund coming and you haven't filed returns in many years, I believe it's 3 years from the date the tax return was due. If you wait longer than that, whatever refund you have coming, you're not going to get. The statute of limitations expires. If you owe taxes, then yes, interest and penalties will accumulate. If you can't afford a tax preparer, there are volunteer income tax preparers. It's called VITA, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, and you can get it through certain colleges and universities who set that up. But you have to call them, as I understand, beginning mid-January, because that's when they start making appointments. And they, from what I know of it, they can assist you with back taxes or delinquent tax returns. But it's an appointment you have to make in plenty of time if you want that kind of assistance. Most paid tax preparers are not going to do that for free.
Okay. But the main thing is, if I don't owe any tax when I do file, there's no penalty. But the thing is, I could risk losing one of my refunds.
That is correct.
Can you say the name of that organization or what the umbrella term is so that I can?
It's called VITA, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance. And if you have access to a computer, you can just type in that in whatever search engine you want to use, and you should be able to find one of those programs in your city or in your area. I know there's one through in San Mateo, through one of the colleges in San Mateo. It may even be College of San Mateo, but call early.
Yes, I hear that. I wanted to say I pulled off the highway to talk. And one thing I want to say is when you're asked is to give the phone number out maybe one or two more times than you have, because I had to wait for the call, the phone number. You were saying, give a call, and one time you only gave the 800 number and yada-da. So that's just my one suggestion, and just also my appreciation. And I am grateful for the show. I listened to it till I forget his name, but the man who did this before for
that would
years.
Be Chuck Finney. He was the genius created this broadcast.
Yes. And even though I don't need much legal advice, I like listening to it. I get stuff, and I thank you for carrying it on.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate hearing that.
Okay. And a grateful day for everyone tomorrow.
Thank you. And you as well. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. You know, Justine brought up a comment and made me wonder, what about somebody somewhat similarly situated who hasn't filed their tax returns in recent years? And in 1 year, they would have been entitled to a refund, but they waited too long. And in another year, they owed money. can you apply that refund you would have gotten? The limitations period has gone. But have they waived any right to offset the tax they owe with that refund?
Yes. Cindy, I don't know if you differ, but once the refund is gone, it's gone.
That is true. One thing I would like to add is the statute of limitations for California is 4 years, so you get one extra year. And let's say, for example, you're not ready to file your return. You can file a protective claim or a claim for refund for the IRS to say, hey, I'm due a refund. You may not have all the facts and the proof, but you can file that claim, which will toll that statute and give you more time. And you can file a protective claim with the FTB, California, which will also toll that statute.
So if you think that it's you may be entitled to something you don't know, you haven't done your taxes, at least let them know before the time runs out.
Right. I think it would be prudent to articulate why you're owed a refund, just to say, hey, I'm owed a refund, and you don't state a basis for that. The IRS could deem that as an invalid claim. So unless you do a formal claim for refund.
So here we are at the end of the year. And I guess the next couple things I want to talk about are things that maybe we should consider doing before the year's out. Should I prepay or front load some of my medical expenses so that I have them to write off this year?
You can, although out-of-pocket medical expenses are subject to that 7.5% AGI threshold. So you can pay medical expenses. So if you know, for example, you have a procedure and you have the option to prepay, you can pay it in this year and deduct it on the 2025 tax return.
I know there was a practice at one time of prepaying state taxes. Can you still do that? And when is it a good idea?
When you say prepay state taxes, which are you talking about, state income tax?
Yes, to be used in future years. Maybe I want to take that deduction and bump up my SALT deduction. Does it make sense to prepaid state taxes?
I'm not sure about my answer here, but as I understand it, you may not deduct taxes that have not yet been assessed. So when the SALT tax limitation came into play, many people decided they were going to prepay property taxes for future years to pull them into that last year where there was no SALT tax deduction. That was disallowed because that property tax had not been assessed yet. So if you want to pay income tax for a year that hasn't arrived and you are not, and you're making a prepaid estimated tax payment for the following year, that might prove problematic because you don't know what tax has been assessed yet. Cindy, you may have a better answer for that than I do.
I would agree with that. So I think that, for example, if it hasn't been assessed yet, I don't think it's going to be a deduction that's going to be allowed. But for example, I think for property tax, and it may vary for certain counties, you'll get your property tax bill sometimes next year, and they're like paid in installments, right? I think by the time you get the bill, they might have already been assessed. So you may want to just check to see if they've already been assessed. You just haven't gotten the bill yet because the assessor's office, what they do is the tax collector's office might send it off at a different cycle time. So,
and for a business owner, do I want a 1095 the gardener? What if I'm a homeowner? Do I want a 1095 the 1099 the gardener? Or the housekeeper, for that matter.
So you're required to issue a 1099, and the new rule will be, the current rule is for any payments over $600. And then in 2026, it'll be $2,000. It's very important to 1099 the gardener if the gardener is providing services for a rental property, investment property. The reason why is because you're going to want to take that deduction. And I've seen audit cases where if you don't issue a 1099 to the gardener, sometimes they can take a position that you're not entitled to the deduction. I actually don't think that's a fair assessment of the law, but they can impose penalties for failure to file 1099s. And if you're supposed to file 1099s, it's not a huge penalty. Is it? Yeah, I think it's $100.
It's $50.
$50.
We're running low on time, and I probably shouldn't have saved this one area till so late in the show. But what should I be doing about my own retirement? Should I be putting money between now and year's end in a Roth IRA or a SEP IRA, a self-directed IRA? What do you recommend for most folks?
Well, that's a complicated question.
That's a show.
I tell my clients who are self-employed, or if they are employed, in my opinion, you should make the maximum contribution allowed, provided you can afford to do that. You do not have to save a lot of money to accumulate a substantial amount of retirement income. If you save what you can each year, invest it prudently, you can wind up with substantial retirement income. And that's the advice I give everyone, whether they're self-employed or not. If you're self-employed, you have a variety of options. You can do a simple, you can do an IRA, you can do a self, what's called a SEP, Simplified Employee Pension IRA. You can do something called a KEO plan, which entails what's known as a profit sharing plan or a money purchase plan. Those are more complicated discussions, but everyone should be preparing for their retirement. It's something that has not been done, and that lack of planning will really come back to hurt you. I've had clients who have had to do some drastic things to gain funds on which to live because they did not plan for retirement. And it really hurts when you have to do that.
I wanted to give you each a couple minutes for any last thoughts you might have. Frank, would you like to take 2 minutes for any final remarks?
I think what I just said is probably what I would have said regarding retirement. I don't really have any other input. The changes coming to the tax code are going to affect most people, and in my opinion, it's going to be a positive effect. The standard deduction is higher. The lack of the exemption for some portion of Social Security tax via the tax exemption for seniors is helpful. But I would also say, and this is something I heard during one of the seminars that I take, and that is, they say that the tax changes are permanent. Well, they're only permanent until the next law changes them. So all tax law is temporary. It's the next administration, depending on who it is, may enhance the code that's more friendly to taxpayers. It may not. It may ask more from taxpayers. So there's really no way to tell. Each administration, even a continuation of an administration, can significantly alter the code.
When it comes right down to it, isn't the tax code simply a way for the present government, whatever present government that might be at the time, of directing that money gets moved from one sector to another? So they might soften the hit in one area when they want to promote that activity and make it a little harsher in another? Isn't that really what the tax code's all about?
I think the tax code is about the gathering funds for whatever state, federal, or local tax authority needs money. How they direct it is, that's a matter of expenditure. So,
Cindy, you want to take a couple minutes, 2-3 minutes, probably 2 minutes or so?
I would also, you know, suggest that your listeners review their health savings accounts just to make sure that that's maxed out. If, you know, we had a volatile stock market, if you have gains and you want to harvest some of your losses, you can sell some of your security positions to offset those capital gains. If you're subject to required minimum distributions, you're 73 or older, you just want to make sure you take those required minimum distributions by December 31st of 2025, and make sure to make those estimated tax payments. So you don't want to get hit with any estimated tax payment penalties. The last estimated tax payment deadline is January 15th of 2025. And then also, lastly, if you want to give gifts, there's the annual gift exclusion of $19,000, $38,000 per couple. So you just want to make sure you give those gifts to the grandchildren before December 31st of 2025.
Tell me a little bit more about the gifts to the grandchildren. You're talking about present time gifts?
Yes, present time gifts. So let's say, for example, you have a very sizable estate. One way to move money from your estate to avoid estate taxes, if you're subject to it, is to give annual gifts. So if you have heirs, children, grandchildren that are ultimately going to inherit your estate, you can start giving that away during your lifetime, and you're able to give up to $19,000, $38,000 per couple.
All righty. Thank you both. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight's been our yearly year-end tax tips program. Our guests tonight have been Cindy Ho of Cindy Ho Law, APC in San Jose. Ms. Ho is a member of the taxation section of the California Lawyers Association. And Frank Adam of Pacifica. Frank is a great supporter of Your Legal Rights and our Call a Lawyer Night feature. He's a certified public accountant, an attorney, a real estate broker, man about town. Thank you both for joining us. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, where, as always, and this will be our last landlord-tenant program of the year, but as always, we take your calls and answer your questions. Once again, thanks to all of you, to our distinguished guests, Frank and Cindy, for joining us, and all of you for listening. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.